hardest part of being homeless is the loneliness.
Loneliness is the hardest part of being human.
Lately, we all know what it's like to feel lonely and disconnected.
But a simple meal can bring us together in amazing ways.
At Union Gospel Mission, a meal connects people to a community where lives are transformed.
You can give a meal that can bring people together in life-changing ways.
Give now at ugm.ca.
Hi there, this is Jan Arden, and if you're listening to Something Fabulous, well, you're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM Simon Fraser University Radio, streaming on the internet at cjsf.ca.
This is broadcasting from Burnaby Mountain.
It's not just rich people that own the media.
But by leaving out the most important things you need to know, they can elevate awareness to a new all-time low.
I own my media.
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 The Media Co-op is a grassroots national news network that's owned by its members.
But if it's just left out, can you say the paper lied? A lot of things that happened didn't happen after all. If there's no one in the forest who will put it in the news, I guess the tree didn't fall.
Join us today at mediacoop.ca/join.
I'm joining today. You should too.
It's Christmas time. There's no need to be afraid. At Christmas time, we let in light and we banish shame. And in our world of plenty, we can spread a smile of joy. Throw your arms around the world at Christmas time.
Pray for the other ones at Christmas
Do They Know It's Christmas Time? Was written in 1984 by Bob Geldof and Midge Ure. They wrote the song in reaction to television reports of the 1983 to 1985 famine in Ethiopia. The song was recorded in a single day in November 1984 by Band Aid. Band Aid was a supergroup that was put together by Geldof and Ure and consisted of British and Irish musical acts of the time. It was a great song that much music was in its inception, and it was so new. And so I remember seeing this video as a young woman and being so inspired. It was a great tune and continues to be a great tune. Interesting, there have been subsequent groups that have recorded the song Band Aid 2, Band Aid 3. So you can see different versions online of the various groups. But you want to check out the 1984 recording because it's pretty fabulous. You get to see acts such as Sting and U2, and just to see them when they were really, really young. It's pretty inspiring. And coming up next, I've got a Canadian singer-songrighter, Sufjan Stevens, with his song, Sister Sun. Let's go to that now.
Oh, my friends, I've begun to worry right where I should be grateful, I should be satisfied. Oh, my heart, I would clap and dance in place with my friends. I have so much pleasure to embrace, but my heart is returned to Sister Winter.
Summertime, when I get
And this brings us to the Story Corner portion of tonight's show. I will be reading from A Christmas Memory. This story was written by Truman Capote and published in Mademoiselle magazine in December 1956. It was reprinted in 1963 in the book The Selected Writings of Truman Capote, and later was published once again in the hardcover edition in 1966. It is called A Christmas Memory. Imagine a morning in late November. A coming of winter morning, more than 20 years ago. Consider the kitchen of a spreading old house in a country town. A great black stove is its main feature, but there is also a big round table and a fireplace with two rocking chairs placed in front of it. Just today, the fireplace commenced its seasonal roar. A woman with shorn white hair is standing at the kitchen window. She is wearing tennis shoes and a shapeless gray sweater over a summery calico dress. She is small and sprightly, like a bantam hen, but due to a long youthful illness, her shoulders are pitifully hunched. Her face is remarkable, not unlike Lincoln's, craggy like that and tinted by sun and wind. But it is delicate, too, finely boned, and her eyes are sherry-colored and timid. "Oh, my!" she exclaims, her breath smoking the windowpane. It's fruitcake weather. The person to whom she is speaking is myself. I am 7. She is 60-something. We are cousins, very distant ones, and we have lived together, well, as long as I can remember. Other people inhabit the house, relatives, and though they have power over us and frequently make us cry, we are not, on the whole, too much aware of them. We are each other's best friend. She calls me Buddy, in memory of a boy who was formerly her best friend. The other Buddy died in the 1880s when she was still a child. She is still a child. I knew it before I got out of bed, she says, turning away from the window with a purposeful excitement in her eyes. The courthouse bell sounded so cold and clear, and there were no birds singing. They've gone to warmer country, yes, indeed. Oh, Buddy, stop stuffing biscuit and fetch our buggy. Help me find my hat. We've 30 cakes to bake. It was always the same. A morning arrives in November, and my friend, as though officially inaugurating the Christmas time of year that exhilarates her imagination and fuels the blaze of her heart, announces, "It's fruitcake weather. Fetch our buggy. Help me find my hat." The hat is found, a straw cartwheel corsaged with velvet roses out of doors has faded. It once belonged to a more fashionable relative. Together we guide our buggy, a dilapidated baby carriage, out to the garden and into a grove of pecan trees. The buggy is mine. That is, it was bought for me when I was born. It is made of wicker, rather unraveled, and the wheels wobble like a drunkard's legs. But it is a faithful object. Springtimes. We take it to the woods and fill it with flowers, herbs, wild fern for our porch pots. In the summer, we pile it with picnic paraphernalia and sugarcane fishing poles and roll it down to the edge of a creek. It has its winter uses, too, as a truck for hauling firewood from the yard to the kitchen, as a warm bed for Queenie, our rough little orange and white rat terrier, who has survived distemper and 2 rattlesnake bites. Queenie is trotting beside it now. 3 hours later, we are back in the kitchen, hulling a heaping buggy load of windfall pecans. Our backs hurt from gathering them. How hard they were to find, the main crop having been shaken off the trees and sold by the orchard's owners, who are not us. Among the concealing leaves, the frosted, deceiving grass. Crackle! A cheery crunch. Scraps of miniature thunder sound as the shells collapse and the golden mound of sweet oily ivory meat mounts in the milk glass bowl. Queenie begs to taste, and now and again, my friend sneaks her a mite, though insisting we deprive ourselves. We mustn't, buddy. If we start, we won't stop. And there's scarcely enough as there is for 30 cakes. The kitchen is growing dark. Dark turns the window into a mirror. Our reflections mingle with the rising moon as we work by the fireside in the firelight. At last, when the moon is quite high, we toss the final hull into the fire and with joined sighs watch it catch flame. The buggy is empty. The bowl is brimful. We eat our supper, cold biscuits, bacon, blackberry jam, and discuss tomorrow. Tomorrow, the kind of work I like best begins, buying. Cherries and citron, ginger and vanilla, and canned Hawaiian pineapple. Rinds and raisins, and walnuts and whiskey, and oh, so much flour, butter, so many eggs, spices, flavorings. Why, we'll need a pony to pull the buggy home. But before these purchases can be made, there is the question of money. Neither of us has any, except for skinflint sums persons in the house occasionally provide. A dime is considered very big money. Or what we earn ourselves from various activities, holding rummage sales, selling buckets of hand-picked blackberries, jars of homemade jam and apple jelly and peach preserves, rounding up flowers for funerals and weddings. Once we won 79th prize, $5, in a national football contest. Not that we know a fool thing about football. It's just that we enter any contest we hear about. At the moment, our hopes are centered on the $50,000 grand prize being offered to name a new brand of coffee. We suggested AM, and after some hesitation, for my friend thought it perhaps sacrilegious, the slogan AM, Amen. To tell the truth, our only really profitable enterprise was the Fun and Freak Museum we conducted in a backyard woodshed 2 summers ago. The fun was a stereo opticon with slide views of Washington and New York, lent us by a relative who had been to those places. She was furious when she discovered why we'd borrowed it. The freak was a three-legged bitty chicken hatched by one of our own hens. Everybody hereabouts wanted to see that bitty. We charged grown-ups a nickel, kids 2 cents, and took in a good $20 before the museum shut down due to the decrease of the main attraction. But one day and another, we do each other accumulate Christmas savings, a fruitcake fund. These monies we keep hidden in an ancient bead purse under a loose board under the floor, under a chamber pot, under my friend's bed. The purse is seldom removed from this safe location, except to make a deposit or, as happens every Saturday, a withdrawal. For on Saturdays, I am allowed 10 cents to go to the picture show. My friend has never been to a picture show, nor does she intend to. I'd rather hear you tell the story, buddy. That way I can imagine it more. Besides, a person my age shouldn't squander their eyes. When the Lord comes, let me see him clear. In addition to never having seen a movie, she has never eaten in a restaurant, traveled more than 5 miles from home, received or sent a telegram, read anything except funny papers and the Bible, worn cosmetics, cursed, wished someone harm, told a lie on purpose, let a hungry dog go hungry. Here are a few things she has done and does do. Killed with a hoe the biggest rattlesnake ever seen in this country, 16 rattles. Dip snuff, secretly. Tame hummingbirds, just to try it, till they balance on her finger. Tell ghost stories. We both believe in ghosts. So tingling they chill you in July. Talk to herself. Take walks in the rain. grow the prettiest japonicas in town. Know the recipe for every sort of old-time Indian cure, including a magical wart remover. Now, with supper finished, we retire to the room in a faraway part of the house where my friend sleeps in a scrap quilt-covered iron bed painted rose pink, her favorite color. Silently wallowing in the pleasures of conspiracy, we take the bead purse from its secret place and spill its contents on the scrap quilt. Dollar bills tightly rolled and green as May buds. Somber 50-cent pieces, heavy enough to weight a dead man's eyes. Lovely dimes, the liveliest coin, the one that really jingles. Nickels and quarters worn smooth as creek pebbles, but mostly a hateful heap of bitter-odored pennies. Last summer, others in the house contracted to pay us a penny for every 25 flies we killed. Oh, the carnage of August! The flies that flew up to heaven. Yet it was not work in which we took pride. And as we sit counting pennies, it is as though we were back tabulating dead flies. Neither of us has a head for figures. We count slowly, lose track, start again. According to her calculations, we have $12.73. According to mine, exactly $13. I do hope you're wrong, buddy. We can't mess around with 13. The cakes will fall or put somebody in the cemetery. Why, I wouldn't dream of getting out of bed on the 13th. This is true. She always spends 13ths in bed. So, to be on the safe side, we subtract a penny and toss it out the window. Of the ingredients that go into our fruitcakes, whiskey is the most expensive, as well as the hardest to obtain. State laws forbid its sale, but everybody knows you can buy a bottle from Mr. Ha-Ha Jones. And the next day, having completed our more prosaic shopping, we set out for Mr. Ha-Ha's business address. A sinful, to quote public opinion, fish fry and dancing cafe down by the river. We've been there before and on the same errand. But in previous years, our dealings have been with Ha-Ha's wife, an iodine-dark Indian woman with brassy peroxide hair and a dead-tired disposition. Actually, we've never laid eyes on her husband, though we've heard that he's an Indian too. A giant with razor scars across his cheeks. They call him Ha-Ha because he's so gloomy, a man who never laughs. As we approach his cafe, a large log cabin festooned inside and out with chains of garish gay, naked light bulbs, and standing by the river's muddy branches like gray mist, our steps slow down. Even Queenie stops prancing and sticks close by. People have been murdered in Ha-Ha's cafe. Cut to pieces, hit on the head. There's a case coming up in court next month. Naturally, these goings-on happen at night when the colored lights cast crazy patterns and the Victrola wails. In the daytime, Ha-Ha is shabby and deserted. I knock on the door. Queenie barks. My friend calls. Mrs. Ha-Ha? Ma'am? Anyone home? Footsteps. The door opens. Our hearts overturn. It's Mr. Ha-Ha Jones himself. And he is a giant. He does have scars. Doesn't smile. No, he glowers at us through Satan-tilted eyes and demands to know what you want with Ha-Ha. For a moment, we are too paralyzed to tell. Presently, my friend half finds her voice, a whispery voice at best. If you please, Mr. Ha-Ha, we'd like a quart of your finest whiskey. His eyes tilt more. Would you believe it? Ha-Ha is smiling. Laughing, too. Which one of you is a drinking man? It's for making our fruitcakes, Mr. Ha-Ha. Cooking. This sobers him. He frowns. That's no way to waste good whiskey. Nevertheless, he retreats into the shadowed cafe and seconds later appears carrying a bottle of Daisy Yellow, unlabeled liquor. He demonstrates its sparkle in the sunlight and says, $2. We pay him with nickels and dimes and pennies. Suddenly, as he jangles the coins in his hand like a fistful of dice, his face softens. Tell you what, he proposes, pouring the money back into our bead purse. Just